Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one of the topics that I have brought up quite a few times throughout the past few years is if you are a writer, if you have a book out there, if you have a story out there, then it would really benefit you to try to adapt that story to a different medium. And when I say that, I mean use what resources are there at your disposal and try to get it out there. What I was able to do with the first Excelsior book is I was able to adapt it into an audio drama. And so something that took 7 hours to listen to on audiobook from start to finish, the same story had to be told with a beginning, middle, and end in 2 hours. So obviously, a lot of tightening had to be done and a lot of changes needed to be made in order to make it palatable to the audio drama format. And that is the case with adapting your story to television. It's the same with adapting your story to film. One thing that I am so excited to hear from is different authors that have made that leap, and whether they were filmmakers first that have gotten into writing just to get the story out there in book form and then go back and adapt it, whatever the case, that, you know, the fact that they're able to get their story out there in as many different formats as possible is to definitely be celebrated. And that's why my guest this week is here. Paul Skidmore has been doing this for quite some time as an author, as an audiobook narrator, as a filmmaker. He has several shorts that are out there, but at the same time, he is finishing up on his first feature that is based on one of his books. And I'm so excited for him. I'm so excited for what's to come. And I'm so excited to have this conversation because I am such a sucker for behind the scenes stories when it comes to these sort of projects. So I am really excited to get further into how Paul was able to do this and how he continues to do this, not only for himself, but for other people, which is even more fascinating. So it is my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Mr. Paul Skidmore. Paul, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me, George.
And thank you very much for being here. This is yet another wonderful success story with Podmatch. I've been a user of that site for quite a few years now, and it's been great to connect with so many different people that are just perfect fits for this show. So thank you, Alex, again, for putting this whole, this wonderful platform together for so many people.
Podmatch is one of the most well-designed websites I think I've ever used. It's so focused on what it's doing and serving both the podcast hosts and the guests. I've been really impressed by my experience with it the last few months.
And it's so user-friendly too. You're able to connect with so many different people, and the more you get to learn about them, the more it's just like, why haven't you been on my show sooner? And it's a great feeling to be able to connect with people like that. So this one's definitely a win here, considering everything that you've done. Tell us a little bit about the project that you're very close to finishing up. Is that correct?
Yes, so we're in the final stages. The film is called The Darkness Rolled Over Her, and it's from one of my short stories. I have three short stories and a novel that I've self-published, and it's from one of those short stories called The Darkness Rolled Over Her. It follows Gwen, who is a middle-aged woman who is suffering from depression and loneliness and a lot of things those of us in the middle of our lives think about and feel. And she's decided to check out. She's decided to end her own life. You find that out in the first sentences of the book. And she's got a trip planned that was planned previously with some friends. So she thinks, okay, I'll go on this trip and that'll be a way to kind of say goodbye. They don't know what she's doing. And the trip is a fly fishing retreat. And so she gets paired up with this old fly fisherman named Roy, who's kind of this charming mountain guy. And their budding friendship throughout the day starts to kind of challenge her decision, you know? And there's another young woman on the trip, and her name is Sam. And Sam's in her 20s. And when Gwen looks at Sam, she thinks, that's where I was at her age. and I don't want her to be where I am at my age. And I don't know what to do about that. And so it's sort of this three-way tension between the decision that she's already made and this sort of encouraging relationship from Roy, and then this relationship with Sam, whom she wants to encourage. And so when I got done writing the short story, it was 72 pages paperback. And I thought, this is pretty short. It's a pretty simple, straightforward story. There's no exploding helicopters or robots or cartoon cats or anything. There's about four or five characters. It's all present day. It's mostly exterior day outside. Mm-hmm. I was like, for my freelance business, I've got a camera, I've got lenses, I got microphones, I got lights and stuff. I think maybe we can make a movie out of this.
Nice.
And I brought it to my buddy Noah on August 17th of 2020. I said, by September 16th of 2020, that was our first day of production.
Wow. So
in less than a calendar month, we went from, I wonder if we can make a movie out of this, to rolling on shot one. It was a whirlwind. I couldn't believe it. But I just sort of took it as a providential nod, like, yes, this is, you're headed in the direction that you're supposed to go. And post-production has not gone as fast. Post-production has been 5 years now, because it's just me and Noah. Noah's doing a lot of the heavy visual effects. I'm doing some of them. And so now I'm putting my producer cap back on and figuring out distribution and that sort of thing. But I wrote it, I produced it, I directed it, I shot it, I edited it, I did the sound design, done the color correction, doing some of the visual effects. Pretty much the only major things that I haven't done on it are the big visual effects and the score. I've had other friends that have done those things, but it's very much been a passion project from the time I started writing the short story until hopefully later this year, releasing the film for other people to see finally.
It's fabulous. And it's great that you have such a good support system over there, because you're based out of Tennessee. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm in Murfreesboro, which is kind of outside Nashville area in Middle Tennessee. Mm-hmm.
So what's the creative community like around there? Were you able to find the people that you needed pretty quickly?
Yeah. So there's a pretty decent video and film community, even in Murfreesboro, but certainly in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And I'd actually moved to Murfreesboro because I wanted to be closer to Nashville. I was living in Memphis before that. There's a pretty good community in Memphis too, but Nashville's just too expensive. My brother and his family lived in Murfreesboro. So I thought, well, I'll start out there. And 14 years later, I'm still in Murfreesboro, but I'm enjoying it. I like Murfreesboro.
Nice.
But mostly I've found people that I can rely on and trust. And really, my buddy Noah is the number one. Mm-hmm. He goes with me on all my freelance stuff. Even if I don't need him, I'm like, will you just come? Because sometimes my brain gets focused on so many things. Sometimes he can sort of see the tree for the forest that I miss.
Yep.
And so I just like having him there with me. One of our favorite trips was a couple of years ago, an orphanage down in Ensenada, Mexico, which is out in Baja California, out on the West Coast. They wanted us to come out and do some video production. And so Noah and I drove in my little Subaru. We just packed it to the gills and drove from Nashville all the way to Ensenada, Mexico and back. And we just made a big road trip out of it. Noah's been my right hand now for many years, and excellent filmmaker in his own right. He does some Lego stop motion things. And so he's very creative. When we were working on this, he was capable of directing it himself. He's capable of shooting it and lighting it himself. Not one time during this entire production did he say, well, what I would do is, or, well, okay, do that if you want. He was so gracious and patient and just was there to help me make the thing that I was making. When you receive that kind of loyalty from somebody, you just want to give it back in spades. And I've told him, anything that you're doing that you need help with, if you need me as a grip or a PA or whatever, I will show up and I will work. I don't care what it is.
That's so cool.
We are still getting things finished, but when we were filming, most days our crew was three people.
Really?
Our entire crew. Yeah. It was me and Noah and this one girl, Caitlin, who was our production assistant. And she had been on a lot of sets and done commercials and short films and things. So she could hold a boom or a reflector or do the slate or something like that. But she did not have a lot of extensive, she wasn't setting up lights or changing lenses or anything like that. And so really me and Noah were the full technical crew for pretty much the entire film. There was a couple of days where we had some other knowledgeable help. I think the most we ever had on set at one time crew-wise was five people. And that was just for a few hours. So it's one of the smallest productions I've ever worked on, including film school. I mean, first year film school, some of our first class productions are five people in the crew. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. It was incredible. I don't ever want to do it again, but it just lends to that thing of like me and Noah get to look at this and go, this is ours. We made this and this belongs to us and nobody can ever take that away from us.
That's fabulous. Like the way that you were able to get it set up for so many different formats. Now, was filmmaking really like the first love that you had? And then you fell back into writing?
So I was born in 1978. So by the time I'm 5, 6, 7, the movies that are in the theater and on HBO and on TV, Star Wars, it's Back to the Future, it's the Goonies, it's Superman the movie. Getting into junior high and high school, it's Jurassic Park and Michael Keaton Batman and think Lethal Weapon and Die Hard. And so just the great classics of the 80s and the early 90s. And that's
really
what I grew up on.
Special. Yeah.
It was so good. And like Jerry Seinfeld said, these were not movies. These were career options, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I got old enough to realize, okay, maybe you can't be a Ghostbuster for a living. Maybe you just watch the movie and enjoy it. Right. Then I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll just make movies like that and tell stories like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got even older, really even after film school, I just realized how powerful the medium really was, the psychology behind it, mm-hmm. and the persuasion that's sort of built into it, whether you know what's happening or not. I just realized this is a very important art form for like the movie Inception,
mm-hmm.
the Nolans have basically said, we wrote this essentially about filmmaking, that the movie is about people being asleep and going into their dreams. But he said, but filmmaking, that's what it is you sort of get in someone's mind and you plant something that they think belongs to them. And it's a very powerful medium. And yeah. I just want to be responsible and ethical with it. I want to enrich people's lives with it. And I really want to use it to shine light into the darkest places, you know? And so a few years ago, I had just finished working for a big organization and was a little bit creatively burnt out and spent some time just resting for about a month. And mm-hmm. towards the end of that sort of rest period, I had this story in my mind that I couldn't get out of my head, to the point that one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, I just thought, well, I can't sleep and laying here is no fun. So I'm going to get up and get dressed. And I drove down to Waffle House since they were open at 2 o'clock in the morning. And took my iPad and wrote 3,500 words, chapter one, and went back the next night and another 1,500, 2,000 words, chapter two, and just started crafting what would eventually is going to be a novel. I've still not finished with that one, but I put a pause on that and decided I probably should start with something smaller first, because I don't even really read books. Like, I'm a movie guy, so I don't know. I don't know what readers expect. I don't know how to do book art. I don't know how to publish to Apple Books and Amazon or whatever. I don't know how to do a paperback. I don't know how to do any of this. Let me figure that out with something small first. And so I released my first short story called Kindling. I released it in May of 2018. And it was so funny to me because people said, oh, I didn't know that you were a writer. And I was like, well, mm-hmm. what do you think I've been doing for 30 years? Like, where do you think all this film stuff came from? Like, they don't, but and then I had to remember, well, they don't see the script. They don't see the writing part. They don't see by mm-hmm. all my extensive notes and the fact that I'm writing for hours and hours every day. They didn't know. And so when they see the short story that they can download and read, they thought that was very cool. And it just kind of went from there. But The Darkness Rolled Over Her was not a story that I wanted to be able to do paperbacks. So many people wanted a paperback, didn't want to just do eBooks. Mm-hmm. And I thought Link's too short to do a paperback. So I need to do multiple short stories and put together like a little anthology or something.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to like whip out some short stories so I could put a little anthology together. And The Darkness Rolled Over Her was one of those. It just kind of started from nothing and took on a life of its own. It's like when you're walking a big dog and people say, are you walking it or is it walking you? I think this story has been walking me for the last 6 years now.
That's a great way to look at it.
I'm fine with it. Yeah.
That's really cool. It's almost like, I know what you mean when it comes to having a story in you, not really sure exactly how to get it out. Mm-hmm. And then you're trying a different way. Cause yeah, I definitely grew up at the same time. I was born in 76. So mm-hmm. my movie tastes were almost exactly the same. Like, I fell in love with HBO during the time when it stood for, hey, Beastmaster's on. And so that was basically like what one of the constants that we always had during those years. And just growing up with all the great stuff that we were gifted. And in a lot of cases, thanks to the FCC loosening the chains on a lot of the child entertainment laws, they were able to present so many great cartoons that still thrive for me to this day. And watching those different types of movies growing up, that inspired me wanting to get my own stuff out there. But I didn't have access to any sort of like film equipment or anything like that. So I pivoted toward writing and eventually getting into writing stories myself. And I think that's why I really got the hang of reading a lot of different novelizations of films. It was just like, if I can't write this story that's set to be a movie, then why don't I write the novelization based on it and see what comes out of that?
Exactly.
And that kind of lent itself to my style too, because my content editor has told me that I have a very cinematic style to my writing. So I just credit that with the novelizations that I collected over the years. When the story first came out, what were your thoughts on that? Did you think there was going to be a future for it in other formats?
No, not at all. I mean, I was part of this venturing into the book world. I figured I might do audiobooks or something because I could see how that would be easy. I've got the stuff to do it. I've got a mic. I've got Final Cut, whatever. I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I don't really remember how seriously I was thinking about that, but I think I considered, oh, I'll just do my own audiobooks as well. That'll be just one more product I can make out of this. Mm-hmm. I don't think I thought that any of them would turn into a movie necessarily. And again, The Darkness Rolled Over Her, it just was the right length and it was the right complexity and it was just the right setting. You know, if it was, because I have short films I wanted to make for 10, 15, 20 years, but yeah, there's robots, there's 3 feet of snow on the ground, there's all this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, you got to have $500,000 to even make this look good. And that's part of the reason I went to writing, because I was like, I don't need $500,000. I need $5 to pay for a donut and coffee at the donut shop, to sit at the donut shop at 2 o'clock in the morning where I wrote all my books and use their free Wi-Fi. And I just mainly kind of did it because it was cheaper and easier. I didn't need a whole crew of people or whatever. Mm-hmm. But as this particular story, when it was done from a logistical perspective, it just kind of made sense. But also from a story perspective, because when I set out to write it, mm-hmm. So my dad's a fly fisherman, and my dad had an experience where he was a guide for a day with a group sort of similar to what is in the book. The fisherman is not really based on my dad. This is not really based on that event or anything, but it just kind of sparked this idea. And as I was trying to come up with stories, I was like, oh, I could do something with this fly fisherman and this trying to teach this stranger how to do fly fishing. Mm-hmm. And when my dad taught me fly fishing, he's been doing it for 70 years or something probably. And he tried to teach me a couple of times. But the thing that I remember is as a kid, he would get me a can of corn or a can of worms or something, sort of stick me on a rock for a few hours. And I would just drop it in and wait for something to come by, which may have been just to get me out of his way for 3 or 4 hours. That may have been, I don't know how effective that kind of fishing is, but with fly fishing, you're in the water and you are casting upstream and the water is constantly bringing your fly back to you. And you have to be, you're casting upstream because the fish are looking upstream. If they see you, they'll go away. So you have to be behind them. And so you throw and you cast up there. And if there's nothing biting up there, then there's no point in standing there all day. If there's nothing biting, well, you move on. And that's the thing that I remember from that first day of him trying to teach me how to fly fish was just like, we never stopped moving. I mean, we walked in the East Tennessee mountains, you're going uphill over these big rocks and this water coming down, it's strong, cold, ice cold water coming off the mountains. You might only walk a mile and a half or something like that, but it's probably physically the equivalent of a 7 or 10 mile hike. I mean, it's pretty grueling going uphill and going over all those rocks and walking through that water and being on your feet the whole time on those rocks and everything. I mean, it'll wear you out. And I was just thinking about that idea of having to keep moving. And so that's where the story began, was basically kind of a parable about the idea that if you lay down in the water will rush over you and you won't last very long. And so you got to keep moving. And so I needed a character who decided to stop moving. So it began with somebody who needed encouragement to keep moving. And I just sort of turned up the volume on that until it was somebody that had just decided to stop. And at that point it became about somebody taking their own life, which I'm not what I would call classically suicidal. Mm-hmm. There've been days that I've woken up and looked at the ceiling and thought, if today's going to be like yesterday, I don't know if I want to do that anymore. If this is going to be like the previous 100 days, I don't know. I don't want to do this anymore. I've never made plans or anything like that, but it's not so much that I wanted to not live. I just didn't want to live the life I was currently living.
You just knew that something had to change.
Absolutely. I did not want to live this life anymore. Right.
Yeah.
And so I knew that's kind of the story that I wanted to tell and kind of draw on those things. But once it became about suicide specifically, I had some people in my life. I have two friends that have attempted and lived, thank God. And they were very gracious to read an early draft and give me some feedback, which was extremely helpful. I used the metaphor of, like I said, turning up the volume.
Yeah.
And just like a speaker system, when you turn up the volume, it distorts at the top if you turn it up too loud. And that distortion doesn't sound like the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And so I needed help from them. I needed to know, okay, I can sort of amp up how I felt, but I know there's some distortion up here that I'm not familiar with that you can help me with. And they were very helpful with that kind of stuff.
That's great.
I have another friend that lost her father to suicide. Mm-hmm. And so she was able to discuss about it from that point of view, living with it beforehand and dealing with it afterward. And just the journey that she went through as a family member.
So like channel it, you know, like into that.
she was just able to help me sort of understand the dynamic of it so that I could make Gwen as realistic a character as possible. Mm-hmm. And then I had another friend that was a counselor, and she counseled a number of people through suicidal times. Mm-hmm. And she gave me a lot of help with Gwen's character as well, but she really helped me with Roy and Mrs. Hittlemeyer and some of the other characters, because I also wanted some of the other characters to behave toward Gwen in such a way that someone reading might look at that and go, oh, that's a good way to do that. I hadn't thought about that. That's how I should respond. Mm-hmm. And because I want the book to be not just for people who are in that space, but I want it to be for friends and family of people who are in that space, so they'll understand what that person is going through, but also like healthy ways of interacting.
Yeah.
And so when the book became about that, that's when it really started taking on a life of its own. And I got very serious about it. And then after the book was done, like I said, this makes sense to do as a movie. And we started on that. But before we even did that, an acquaintance of mine, it's somebody I've known my whole life, but not known well, somebody I went to church with back home.
Yeah.
And she'd read the book. And so she stopped me in the hallway when I was there visiting, said, oh, I read the book and I love this part and that part. And very quickly, we both got to talking about kind of personal things that you don't normally talk about with an acquaintance in the hallway. But she just felt comfortable doing it because having read the book, she knew that I understood about that. I felt comfortable opening up because she was opening up, and because now I knew that she knew too. That's one of the things about sort of the mental health space that the book deals with, is you get so isolated and you think no one understands what you're going through, when actually many people understand and also don't talk about it and think they're the only one. And mm-hmm. So once I saw that having the book could initiate a conversation like that between people who were just kind of acquaintances, I thought, how do I make that happen? How do I get every person who reads this book to do that? And so that's when we developed this little mini book club called Five Coffees and a Book, where you can take the book to a couple of your friends. And over the course of 5 weeks, you've read the book and you just kind of discuss it together. And we've got a little discussion guide that we put together. And so the ebook of The Darkness Rolled Over Her is available totally for free. The mm-hmm. Five Coffees and a Book discussion guide is available totally for free. I just want people to have this experience. And we are adjusting the Five Coffees and a Book thing for the movie, you know, as the movie's about to come out. We've got some plans for that in the works as well, because I'm a filmmaker. I want to do this for a living, which means I need somebody to pay for something at some point.
Of course.
Buy some coffee mugs or t-shirts. I'll take your money. I'll gladly do that. But I don't know. I just thought, okay, there's going to be some 15-year-old kid that is in a spot and wants to read this book. And I don't want them, because it's 99 cents or whatever, and they don't have a parent's credit card or something. It's like, I just want them to be able to get it.
You just want the story to be accessible.
I just want it to be there and be out there and be there for people. Yeah. So if you want to buy a paperback, please do. But the ebook is there available for free. All that's for free at fivecoffeesandabook.com.
Excellent. That's so great. And it kind of reminds me a little bit about what Robert Rodriguez once said when he was talking about making El Mariachi. He made that for only $7,000. And he said that the main key that brought that about was he took stock in what he had. And he said, I had a school bus, I had a garage, I got a guitar case, and I had a turtle. So all three of those he knew were going to be in this movie. So it sounds like even though you originally didn't plan on getting it just beyond that original story, it sounds like you were planning for it by keeping it as low budget as possible.
I wasn't really thinking about it when I was writing the story. But once the story was done, another short story that became a novel, because it was not a short story as I thought it was,
right,
is God Rest You Merry Gentlemen. That's the name of my novel. It's a Cold mm-hmm. War Christmas story. Ooh. And I love it. I think it's a fun little story. It's a story that I've kind of wanted to tell in some way for a while and really sit down to flesh it out. But like when I got done with that, like I have to have the big room to shoot it in. Everybody's got to have an Air Force uniform. It's set in 1955. You got to make sure your stapler and your telephone and the pencils and everything are all 1955 compliant. That's a big deal. I can't do that with what I have. But when we got done with The Darkness Rolled Over Her, I was like, we could start shooting this tomorrow if we just find the cast.
That's wild.
It was very cool. We were able to find a cast and crew very quickly just through Facebook groups. Oh, in fact, Caitlin, so our PA that I mentioned before, she was actually just a sub for the first day, because our art director that had put some props and stuff together, by the time I scheduled the first day, she had another shoot already scheduled for that day. And we didn't really need her, but I kind of wanted another set of hands on set. She said, I found somebody to replace me, and her name's Caitlin. She's great. You'll love her. So she was supposed to just be there for that one day. Mm-hmm. She liked being with us on set. She liked the story and the project. And she said, can I come back and work other days? I said, you can work every day that you want. You just need to understand, I don't have any money. Like, if you're here, I'll feed you. We've got food money, but I don't. She's like, no, I understand. I just want to work on it. I was like, okay. And so of our 18 days of principal photography, she was at 16 of them.
Oh, that's great. And she came in as a recommendation too.
So she came in as a sub on day one.
Definitely had to put your mind at ease there.
She was coming from Nashville down to Murfreesboro, which is like a 20-30 minute drive.
Oh, and wow.
Then one of the days that she missed in the middle of the shoot was because she had to move. And we're like, mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, of course, no problem. What I didn't realize was she moved to Kentucky.
No kidding.
I thought she was like moving from an apartment to another apartment or something.
Yeah.
She was, so for the second half of the shoot, she was driving down from Louisville. It's like a 2-hour drive.
Wow.
We didn't have any idea until the last day. I was like, Caitlin, what are you? She's like, oh, it's no problem. It's like, okay. Yeah.
Excellent. Were you able to like give her at least a little bit of gas money or something?
I think we gave her a gas card or something, but she's somebody that has my undying loyalty for the end of time.
That's terrific. That's so cool. So you have the cast and crew, and that was one thing I was going to ask before. So you have the cast and crew, which is something that I was going to ask before. You said you were able to assemble everyone from Facebook groups. Do you have a Facebook group of your own for this production company?
Yeah, Parabolas has a Facebook group. We've got an Instagram. We're on X. Every now and then a new social media thing will pop up and I'll hop over there and just secure the Parabolas name sometimes. Sometimes I wait a couple of weeks to see if we're ever going to hear of the social media thing ever again. But yeah, so it's an entity out there. But the Facebook groups that we found it through were like Nashville Film Guild. It was like
a bunch
of people like looking for work or doing short films or posting mm-hmm. their reels or whatever on there. And there's another one like Tennessee Casting Call, that kind of thing that we put up. Mm-hmm. But really, the lady who plays Gwen, I found her because a couple of months before we made the movie, one of the freelance jobs that Noah and I did was some medical training videos. Mm-hmm. And she's both a nurse and an actress. So she came in to do some of that. And I just thought, man, she's like the right look and the right age. And she's got a real naturalistic performance and she's hilarious to be around. And I had met her son. So like she was kind of a known entity sort of, even though I hadn't met her before. I was like, I know her family and I know sort of the community that she's part of. And so when I got the cast list done, I sent it to her and like 5 minutes later, she called me. She's like, I want this part. I want to read for this part. I didn't tell her like I had her in mind. I was like, oh, we'll see. We'll do a reading or something. But I love that she was so excited about it. And I don't know that I'll ever have another actor or actress that was as dedicated to a role as Carrie was to playing Gwen. Mm-hmm. She just wanted to learn. She wanted to go there. She took directions well. She mm-hmm. said from day one, she's like, I want to do this. And I want to do it really good for the film and for the audience because I think they deserve it. And she said, I want to do it really good for you because I know how important this project is for you. And she said, I want to do it really good for me too. She said, because this is something that I feel like I really need to do in my life. And she said, so I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to learn, teach me, direct me. I want to learn from this. I want to grow from this. And we just had the best time. It was a fantastic director, actor relationship. And she said at the beginning, she said, I think I know the perfect person to play Roy also. And so her buddy, Phil Moat, plays Roy. And I mean, he was perfect and he had the perfect beard and just the perfect look. And he's a fantastic actor. We showed up day one, no rehearsals, nothing. We're just day one of shooting. And I was like, I don't know. Did you get those YouTubes? Like, yeah, I got them. I was like, okay. Well. So we started filming and I was like, oh man, this guy sounds like one of my relatives. It's so funny. If I see him in town or something, I go to talk to him. He sounds so different because I've been watching for 5 years. I've been listening to him talk like he's from East Tennessee. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he was really fantastic. And then a lot of the other casts we just got through like the Tennessee Actors Casting Calls group. Mm-hmm. A lot of the other roles only had to do a couple of days or whatever.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the little non-speaking roles and stuff are people that have helped me in my book journey. My friends that designed my book cover art, they're in mm-hmm. it. Some other author friends of mine they play some of the women that are on the bus with Gwen. My mom and dad are in it. So mm-hmm. Phil looks great, looks the part as a fly fisherman, has never fly fished in his life.
Wow.
So you see him cast, and then we immediately cut to behind my dad so we can get the nice, beautiful fly fishing.
The nice casting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you can't tell. It works pretty well. And funnily enough, I had a wig that I bought way back in film school in 1999, and it was a blonde sort of shoulder length wig. It was the exact color, style, and length of Carrie's hair in the movie. And I just held on to it for 20 years. And so when I was locked down with mom and dad during COVID, the three of us went up to East Tennessee mountains and dad fly fished and mom wore Carrie's wardrobe with that wig on. And so some of the big wide shots of them on the river is actually my parents.
That's so smart. That's a great way to do it.
It was kind of like, it was one of the most fun days. I mean, that's one that like, decades from now, I'll be thinking about that day and spending that time with mom and dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
My brother's in it too. He wasn't supposed to have a speaking role, but my cousin, who was supposed to do the prayer at the campsite dinner that they have, he had just been doing a music show and had been exposed to somebody that maybe had COVID. It was ended up not being anything, but he decided maybe he shouldn't come. So my brother stepped in to do the prayer. My brother's a youth minister. So it's like, of course I should have had him do the prayer in the first place.
Oh, there you go.
And so to have my whole family in there, to have my cousins from both sides of my family in there, my friends that have helped me on my creative journey, even coffee and the donuts in the movie are my friends that roast coffee beans. I drink his coffee at home every day. And the donut shop where I wrote the books, they gave us free donuts. So you see boxes of their donuts. So oh, it's just all great. Throughout the film, it's just that community that you were talking about, that supportive community mm-hmm. is represented on screen.
Oh, that's so cool. And then once everything was finished with the initial short that you did, were you able to screen that at any theaters?
Well, no, so we didn't make a short of this. So right. There, I do have three other short films, and the one I did on my own with a group of people in Memphis, it's called Sleepwalking. Right. And then two, I have one's called Time to Pass and the other is called Love is Alive. And those two were done with some friends out of Nashville as part of a group. It was like a summer camp for the Y, and the scripts were written by preteen and teenage students. So those were fun projects to work on, and they ended up being really fun films because the kids are so imaginative. So the only thing really that people have seen of this is just the trailer. I put out the trailer, I don't know, I guess about 3 years ago now. Mm. And so people have seen that. The trailer's about 2 minutes. It's on YouTube. You can search for it, The Darkness Rolled Over Her.
Yeah.
But it's about 2 minutes long. And if you want to know what the book is like, you can watch the trailer. It won't give away the end of the book or anything, but it'll give you a sense of the book and the characters, and sort of you see the story in miniature. It'll give you a good feel for the book as well. The book, because it was only 72 pages, was the perfect length to adapt to the screen. I didn't have to change very much.
Right.
Like you were saying before, television series, movie, book, audiobook, these are all different mediums.
Yes.
With different demands, not just technically, but different expectations from the consumer. Mm-hmm. From the listener or the viewer, right? And the art form itself has different powers. Mm. For instance, think about live theater, okay?
Yeah.
If you're in the third row of a play and a naked person walks on the stage, that's going to be very startling. Mm-hmm. If you're at home and have HBO on and a naked person goes across the screen, like how many times have you seen that? This is boring. But the fact that it's in person just makes it so much more meaningful. It's the exact same thing, but it's different because of the medium. And same thing with the language you use or the music that's available or whatever. There's a power when you're reading of being able to envision everything yourself. Mm-hmm. And there's a persuasive power in that as well. But in a movie, I can only put up what you see and hear. I can't tell you what the characters are thinking and all that. Whereas mm-hmm. a book oftentimes will tell you what the character is thinking and you're envisioning the setting and some of the more physical things. A movie is kind of the opposite where you're seeing all the physical stuff. You don't have to imagine what she looks like. She's right there. But now you have to imagine what she's thinking, you know? And so those were some of the only changes I really had to make in the adaptation were if you go to the first two pages of the book, it's all prose. There's like no dialogue. And it's things like, well, here's the first sentence of like the fourth paragraph. Everything was arranged. She'd had a will for some time. She sent her cat to her aunt's. Like those three sentences, super simple. How do you show that on screen? How do you get that information across?
Yeah.
You know, you can do it so quickly in a book, but you can't do that as quickly in a film. And so that was one of the things I had to do was add a scene with Mrs. Hittlemeyer early in the film before she leaves to go. That is essentially getting across a lot of exposition that's covered in this prose, but I had to put it on screen somehow. And there was just no way to show visually. I had to show that she's made plans that Mrs. Hittlemeyer is going to come and find her after the weekend's over or whatever. But other than a couple of scenes like that, I added a scene to the end as well, just because a book you can kind of sit and chew on. A book you can stop halfway through a sentence and stop and think about it. A movie keeps going, right? So I did add a scene at the end as well to kind of like hammer home a little bit some of the themes of the story. Mm-hmm. But other than those two scenes, it's pretty much one for one right off the page. And that's the beauty of adapting a short story like that. God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, my novel, it's only 44,000 words. It's just barely a novel.
Oh, but
even that, like if it was done one-to-one off the page, would probably be 4 hours or something. So yeah, it does. The different mediums require different things. And so you have to essentially step back and say, what is the essence of the thing that I'm doing here? And what is the best way to communicate that in this particular medium to this particular kind of audience? And now I'll take my same palette, my same characters and setting and plot and all those kind of things, premise and everything. I'll take my same palette, but I'm going to paint a different kind of picture in this other kind of medium over here for the for these different expectations from this other audience. And
right.
So any differences between the film and the book are only for those reasons.
Gotcha. And then, this experience definitely must have been really gratifying for you, because not only have you made the move to adapting one of your books into a feature, but you've also started the process for other people.
Yeah. So I've helped other people make their films right out of film school. I graduated film school in 2002. In 2004, I helped Jeff Nichols produce his first film, which is called Shotgun Stories. Michael Shannon was in it before he got super big. He'd already been, mm-hmm. I think, in 8 Mile with Kim Basinger. Mm-hmm. And I think he'd been in Bad Boys 2 at that point. He gets locked in a trunk in Bad Boys 2, I think, for mm-hmm. one scene. But so that was a big get. We got him through some connections, but he was great. But I helped Jeff make his first film. The film he made after that was called Take Shelter, also with Michael Shannon. And then the third film he made was Mud with Matthew McConaughey. So Jeff's mm-hmm. had a really fantastic career that I've not joined him on, but helped him make that first film in Little Rock. And it was done not too much differently than the way we did this. He shot that on film. We had a crew of 20. They had a little more money, and we did things a little differently. But it was that same kind of thing where it was a passion project for him, and it was something where his friends and family wanted to see him succeed, and the rest of us sort of white-knuckled it for a month and got it made. And then I think that also took about 4 years. I think it was 2004 that we shot the film. I think it was 2008 before the film was released.
Oh, man.
But yeah, and so I've helped other people along the way do some of their things, and I just kept trying to craft my thing. I could have gone to Los Angeles, Hollywood, after film school, mm-hmm. and I think been very successful. I'm not really sure what it would have cost me personally. I'm not sure how mature I was as a person to be able to stick to the things that I wanted to stick to. And so that's kind of one reason why I wanted to stay back in Tennessee. I want to be around my family and sort of my subculture that I know and understand. Mm-hmm. I knew that even in high school, college, if I'm going to make films, that I don't want a studio exec standing over my shoulder telling me I've got to do it this, that, or the other way because right. of some ideology or because of some deal we have with some company or whatever. And so these things, I have other people that I'm responsible to and responsible for, but I've been able to make them my way. I've been able to tell the stories that I want without someone standing over me. Even self-publishing, I have some author friends that really want to do traditional publishing route. And I keep asking them, why do you want to do that? What do you get out of that? And it's sort of like the prestige of being with a publisher, which I get. And I have a friend that got her first novel finally with a publisher, and she sold 25,000 copies or something. I mean, she's done really well with it. And no doubt having a real quote unquote publisher has helped her do that. But I don't know how much she's making per book. It might be a dollar or something, maybe.
Right.
When I sell my novel, I make $7.50 off of each sale. Now, I haven't sold 25,000 copies, but obviously I'd rather have a dollar out of 25,000 copies than $7.50 from 100 copies. Mm-hmm. But I'd rather have $7.50 from 25,000 copies. That's what I'd rather have, you know.
Absolutely.
So I'd rather figure out the part that I'm missing rather than sell my rights or license everything out to somebody else, or let somebody take 30 or 40 or 50 or 60% of what I'm doing. Even Amazon just updated with their print on demand stuff. If your book is less than $9.09 on the store, they're going to take 50% instead of 40% now.
That's understandable considering that they're the ones that are providing the means of getting it out there.
And that's the thing is, so if you have a million followers on Instagram, mm-hmm. and you decide to leave Instagram and go to a different social media platform, guess how many followers you will have when you get over to that other social media platform.
Well, once you get over there, you're going to have zero.
You're going to have zero.
Basically just like kind of starting from scratch.
Because those followers don't belong to you. They belong mm-hmm. to Instagram.
Yep.
And people have had their account shut down either because of something they did or said, or sometimes just because of some kind of fraud or scam or some kind of hack. People mm-hmm. that had their account shut down have lost hundreds of thousands or millions of followers and never been able to get them back and had to rebuild from scratch because it doesn't belong to them.
That's brutal.
You probably have listeners that are authors themselves and filmmakers themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And they just need to know, the only thing that you really kind of own is your email list. If you have a mm-hmm. newsletter, you have some kind of email list, that's really kind of the only thing that you can own and take with you from place to place, because you can export it as a table and import it in the next place. There's a little bit of legal ramifications as far as doing that. But if people have opted into receiving emails from you and you've got that list, then you can sort of take that whatever mechanism you're going to do, whether it's Substack or MailChimp or whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the only thing that you own is that list. Right. And the same goes for theaters. I remember one of our producing teachers, he produced the movie Monkey Shines, which you probably remember, the age that we are. It came out and was supposed to do really well, but I think it did okay the first week, and word of mouth was kind of picking up. But anyway, the studio was like, nah, we're not going to run it for a second week. And so the producers begged, and they're like, please, please run it for a second week. And the studio said, okay, we'll run it for a second week, but we're not spending any on advertising. Why even run it? If nobody knows that it's there, what's the point? And sure enough, nobody went in the second week because they didn't know it was still in the theater because there were no commercials. There was no posters or anything.
That's so disappointing.
Yeah. And so here was this movie that I think maybe that had even been done as a negative pickup, which is where you finance it yourself or whatever. And then you,
And then they sell it. Yeah.
You basically sell it to the studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like you have this thing and you sold it. And now that other person decided they didn't want to do anything with it. And what do you have now? There was a guy. Let's see. He's on Instagram. I think it was Cody Fry, maybe. I think is who it was. He got like a million followers on Instagram by singing and just doing little songs and stuff on Instagram, built his own following, and ended up getting signed by Warner Brothers. And I think it was Warner Brothers. And so he had songs that were like really picked, really trending. They'd already trended in the US maybe a year or two ago, but now because they were on Warner Brothers and that was open in China, he had a lot of Chinese fans that were starting to find out who he was because his music was able to be used on trending reels and stuff on TikTok in China. And Warner Brothers got into some kind of clash with TikTok and took their whole catalog down one of his songs was trending, and it killed it. And it killed all of his new followers and everything.
Yeah.
Because he signed it away. And I just remember thinking, why did you do that? You did the hard part.
Yeah.
The reason people want to get signed by a label is so that they can get noticed and so that people will hear their music. People were already hearing your music. And so that's kind of been my philosophy. Even, you know, when I was a teenager and in college, it was honestly kind of a dumb philosophy because technologically it wasn't even possible what I was
right. I mean, like, yeah, during that time, like I remember when I took the plunge and decided to self-publish what became my novel From Parts Unknown, which has since gone on to have its own set of twists and turns and was completely like broken down to its molecular structure and then remade as like a whole new book that became a 5-part serial that became 2 books, then it became an omnibus edition, and now it's with a new publisher and it's getting set to come out again as a trilogy after the set of rewrites that I now have to do. But originally when From Parts Unknown first came out, it came out in November of 2002, and that's before Kindle, before self-publishing and everything. And the only news I had heard about self-publishing came out the year before in the Complete Idiot's Guide to Publishing Science Fiction. And they have one paragraph about self-publishing, and it says, don't do it. It's a last ditch effort for an author. You'll never be taken seriously. All your books will just be collecting dust in a garage, and there are terrible packages to get into. All it is designed to take your money. And it was just doom and gloom the whole time. And then what do we have 7 years later? The Complete Idiot's Guide to Self-Publishing.
Absolutely.
So I mean, times change. Times change and everything. And thankfully, we had things like the Kindle in order to kind of make it a little bit more palatable for a lot of people to get involved in. And now with ACX and opening the door for audiobooks in the same way for people to just go in and start creating your own books, your own audiobooks based on that. And you've done that as well with some of your stuff, correct?
Yeah, I've got 2 audiobooks, one of Kindling and one of Ciao Bella, which is a 16-page short story.
Oh, that's great.
It's from when I went to Italy and met the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. And it's kind of, if you like David Sedaris essays or something, it's kind of like that.
Oh, very
but,
nice.
The audiobook is really fun. For some reason, I could never get it onto Audible. It was like, why am I even bothering with this? Like, if people want the book, it's not like I was getting a lot of discovery on Audible. That's the only downloads I was getting anyway. So I was like, just put it on. I've got a Gumroad account. I was like, I'll just put it on Gumroad where people can download it and they'll take 10% instead of 40 or 60 or whatever it is.
Gotcha.
But the tools for any of this stuff. And the beauty of it is so many people have adopted it that a lot of these tools are at least free to start now. DaVinci Resolve is what I'm using to cut together my 6K 5.1 surround sound feature film. You can download it for free and have most of the features that I'm using even the iPad version is almost the entire full version of Resolve. It's crazy. DaVinci Resolve is made by Blackmagic Design, the same people that make my camera that I shot my movie with. When I graduated film school, getting a good cinema camera to shoot your movie with, you were looking at $20,000 per lens for the lens, and you're looking at $100,000 plus camera body. Panavision camera, you can't even buy. You have to rent those. You're right. Mm-hmm. But now we shot this movie. All of my lenses, the entire case full of lenses, was like $2,800.
Wow. You know,
and my camera body was like $2,500. And it's like, it looks so good. And there's certainly more expensive versions of everything, but it's like, it's really hard to beat some of this stuff. The quality, the bump in quality I would get is not worth paying 10 times as much or even twice as much. I really like the gear that I've got.
And not only that, but it also kind of pays for itself as time goes on, because it's not like you're renting the camera over and over again.
That's correct. I'm using it for all my freelance stuff and doing my video production stuff. And so it was not something I was making payments on or renting or whatever. It's like stuff that I had. And so, but there are a lot of services now that are like that too. Substack is one that I mentioned before that's I got into in the early days, and they've just added on and added on. But one of the things I really liked about them in the early days was for podcasts. They had a podcast thing built in, and they would do all the hosting for you. I was like, well, that's crazy. I'm like, for free. I was like, okay, because they have a paid side, and they take 10% of your paid stuff, and they coach you on how to become paid. And they have a lot of good support stuff. And it's another organization that I think, man, they understand the new model of stuff, because the new model, here's the thing. Look at Hollywood, man. I love Hollywood movies, and I grew up on them like we were just talking about, but they're imploding. They don't know what. They don't know what they're doing. There's just this Pixar movie they just spent $300 million on, made like $30 million in its opening weekend, and it's going down from there. And the irony that they spend $300 million on only a certain kind of movie because it's too risky to make all these smaller projects. But then when one of these things tank, it's like, I don't know.
And it's almost like they're hurting their own chances to thrive because I mean, like, obviously, they did a very good service for keeping movies relevant for people during the pandemic by offering, in some cases, like day and date release, like on Peacock and Paramount Plus. And then you have this period on HBO Max where they would release a movie day and date with the theaters, but they would keep it for about 30 days or so, and then they would take it off. And then anytime after that, you would have to go see it in the theater. So they wind up kind of hurting themselves in that, because now all of a sudden everyone's just like, why should I wait? Why should I go to the movies when I can just wait a couple of months? And all of a sudden it's there on streaming. The new Captain America is now available on streaming. And I still think like a big part of that, that really hurt its box office chances, was this new model that Disney has adopted by giving it that, by basically just saying it'll be out on streaming very soon. When it comes to looking at the movies that came out as recently as 2019 before the pandemic hit, I don't see any other movie from now on making the kind of numbers that Endgame did. Like Avengers Endgame, that was a culmination of 22 other films that came before it, but still.
So it's kind of like Hollywood Endgame, I think.
Yeah, really? Yeah, like that sort of thing. Like it was, now, thankfully, there are still a good amount of movies that are out there that are still making some good money and everything. But it's the theaters are hurting. Movie theaters are hurting these days.
It is, because look who won like 7 or 8 Oscars at the Oscars this year. Sean Baker, the guy who shot his first big feature film on iPhones. Running around in Florida, and he's done things very, very independently. And even the filmmakers themselves are going, no, we want this. I love Iron Man and whatever. That's fine. But like, enough already. I read an article today where Stephen King is taking back the copyright license of Shawshank Redemption.
Really?
And a lot of people think it's because either a series or a remake is in the works. And I'm just like, guys, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Now, on one hand, it's like nothing is new under the sun. The guy who said that 3,500 years ago. Okay. So I get that maybe the Goonies is kind of like the Odyssey or whatever, but that's different than the 18th Superman reboot in the last decade or whatever. It's like, we can't take it anymore. And there's other things to talk about. At first, when we made this film, I thought, what am I going to do? This film is so small and it's so personal and it's so intimate. Will anybody care? And now that it's taken 5 years to get it done, at this point, I'm like, people are crying out for something like this. People are salivating for a story this intimate and small. And we're developing a distribution strategy that is basically direct to customer and almost just as intimate. I think it's going to be something that people are going to be really blown away by. And it's not going to be a traditional theater, then digital download, then rental, then streaming kind of thing. That stuff will come later. But I just think the way it's an interesting circle that we've gone through, because before technology, the only communication that you had, the only mass communication you had, was in the town square, the village storyteller, or at mass with the church on the corner, or the village crier, or whatever it was, or the gossip just sort of going down the street from your neighbors or whatever. That was the only entertainment, the only stories that you had was whatever you could logistically hear. And then we develop radio and telephone and then television and then the internet and movie theaters. And suddenly things are going all across the world in an instant, and everybody's watching the same thing, and experience of media becomes a very siloed sort of singular thing a little bit. And now we're getting back to this place where people are really craving the thing that humanity really was always built for, which is sort of storytelling, small social, and something that's happening sort of very small and local and being directly connected to the storyteller. And so you're seeing things like Substack really take off, because now they're not publishing through a magazine that you have to like swim through ads to find where the copy is in the article and all that stuff. It's like people are willing to pay $5 a month for somebody that they really want to hear wine reviews from or whatever the topic is. And I think the culture is saying, I think the culture really prefers a decentralized, local, intimate kind of thing. And I think that's really where all this is going to go to. So again, your listeners that are filmmakers or authors, if you want to do the traditional route, go for it. It's still there. But I really think the future is in being as close to the customer as you possibly can, either through a podcast, through your vlogs, through your Instagram story, through your newsletter, and even your final, your books and your movies and things. Kevin Kelly says you got to have your 1,000 true fans. You don't need 1 million followers. You just need 1,000 people that'll buy anything that you make. And then you need to make sure that you make enough that they spend $50 or $100 a year on
you. And you want to take care of them. You want to make sure that you're giving them stories that they are satisfied with, that it's something that they enjoy, that they want to get more of. And you can keep on cultivating that audience, and really has no choice but to grow like after that, because they're going to be so satisfied that they're going to spread the word about you.
Absolutely.
And then who knows what can happen after that.
For sure.
Yeah. So with everything that you've got going, if you come across someone who has a story, but isn't really sure exactly what to do with it in terms of what sort of format they want to use, what sort of questions would you have for them to see if they can kind of like figure out what venue they want to get their stories out in?
My questions would probably be something along the lines of, what do you like? Because God rest you, married gentlemen, I didn't really want to write that. I wanted to watch it, but it didn't exist. So I had to write it. Kindling. That was something that was in my mind that I thought, oh, this would be a great little movie, or a little short film or something. But nobody had ever made it. So I had to write it down. And even though I don't know how feasible it would be as a film, at least on its own, just because it's so short, when I did the audiobook, I was like, oh, I get to kind of sort of pick up my music and have some sound and stuff and kind of make it a little short film kind of. And so the fact that I got to turn The Darkness Rolled Over Her into a feature film is just such a joy. I'm so grateful for the experience. But it comes out of like, what are the kind of stuff you want to watch? We talked about the few short films that I did before. The very first one that I did with that group in Nashville is called Time to Pass. It was written by an 11-year-old girl. Real sweet little story. And I don't know why, but when I read it, it reminded me of on HBO on Saturday mornings, they would have like their morning stuff with like Babar the Elephant and whatever. They'd have like a little Saturday morning thing. And then they would want to have their first movie of the day at like 11 o'clock or whatever, or 1 o'clock. But there'd always be like a little time gap where the schedule didn't work or whatever. And so they'd have to fill it with some little thing. And sometimes there would be like a little 15-minute little short film, just like a little, I don't know, like a little, not a fairy tale, but like a little morality tale, a little parable kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was just like, I want this to feel like that. I want this to feel like one of these old 80s HBO deals. And so that's kind of how we made it, because that's what I wanted to watch. The second year, the Love is Alive was written by a 15-year-old girl named Jessica. Jessica was really into manga comics.
Oh, awesome.
And so I didn't know much about it. She picked out a stack for me to look at, and I felt kind of silly as a 30-year-old man looking at these teenagers, these manga comics falling in love and stuff. And I was like, okay, this is what she's doing. But I just remember thinking, I don't know how accessible this is going to be to a large group of people, and I'm not sure I can do it justice just because I'm not familiar with the language and the tropes and all that kind of stuff. I tell you what I do know. I know Looney Tunes,
there you
which
go.
Is a little bit like this because the story was about a love fairy that comes down and helps these two people fall in love. I know Gazoo from Flintstones.
Flintstones, yep.
I know Calvin and Hobbes, where Calvin's got this imaginary friend kind of thing, which is sort of one of the premise of the story. So I bought like a DVD of like Looney Tunes stuff, and I bought like a set of Calvin and Hobbes comics and went through. And I decided to make the short film kind of more like that because that's what I wanted to watch, you know? Mm-hmm. So that would be my question is like, because there's a lot of advice that you hear that is good advice about here's what's going to make you money. Here's how you're going to get all these followers. Okay. But you just need to understand those are tools, right? Mm-hmm. And even when it's advice, you use it like a tool.
Yeah.
So not everything is a nail. And so you don't always need a hammer, right? Mm-hmm. So what you need to decide story-wise is, What do I enjoy? What will I enjoy working on? What will I enjoy making? Mm-hmm. If somebody has a really great story idea and they hate writing, then maybe being an author is probably not going to be a great time for you.
Right.
But if you like drawing and you get another friend to like maybe write some stuff, maybe a comic book or a graphic novel is the way to go because mm-hmm. that's what you enjoy.
Yep.
So that's really the first place that I would start is my parents both always said to me and my brother, do what you love and the money will come. And neither my brother and I, it's not champagne and limousines or anything, right? No. But we are doing the things that we really love. And the paying work keeps coming around the corner. Mm-hmm. People keep buying a book here and there. And I feel like this movie is going to do well. And that's kind of the advice that I would trend to first. I have tons of technical advice I could give to people about different software to use and different mm-hmm. marketing things and different strategies and stuff like that. But the number one thing is like, what are you going to enjoy? Because if you don't enjoy it, nobody else is going to.
Right.
One of the first things we learned in film school and in our producing class was every film wants to die and no one else cares except for you. And so if you don't keep it on life support, no one else is going to. And so this isn't a follow your passion, follow your dreams. Cause sometimes that advice is terrible, but mm-hmm. this is, if you don't love it, if you don't care about it, no one else is going to. And so you've got to start there. You've got to start with what is the thing that you want to communicate to the world. There's that concept of the ikigai. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's the four intersecting circles. So it's kind of like a diagram of four circles.
Yeah.
And the four circles, if I can remember them, are what the world needs, mm-hmm. what the world will pay you to do, mm-hmm. what you are good at. Mm-hmm. And I forget what the fourth one is, but anyway, something like that. So the intersection of all four of those things is sort of like your life purpose. If you're able to do something that you love doing, that's it. Something you love doing and something you're good at. Cause that's not always the same thing. Right.
Yeah.
I have a friend that really loves being a musician and unfortunately he's not very good. So he's not going to sell a lot of albums, but he loves doing it. So it's not going to be his life mission. It can be a hobby, but it's not going to be a life mission. But if you've got something that you're good at, something mm-hmm. that you love doing, something that you can get paid for, and something the world needs. Those are the four circles. If you've got something in the intersection of all four of those circles, then that's sort of your life purpose and your life mission. The Japanese call it the ikigai.
Nice.
And that's sort of where I would begin. All the other strategy stuff comes after that. All mm-hmm. because that is your, so I'm speaking of this now as a director, right? So the reason mm-hmm. why it's called a director is because when I'm on set, if I got a set, let's say my next film hopefully has 20 or 100 people on crew, my art director, she's figuring out what the set and everything is going to look like. My cinematographer, he's figuring out how to do all the lighting and that kind of stuff. I have mm-hmm. lots of opinions about those things, but I'm not going to do their job for them. Instead, I'm going to say this way, not that way. More of this, less of that, right? I'm directing. I'm showing them which direction we're going to go. And if I don't know what the heart of the story is, if I don't know the ultimate moral message that we're trying to communicate to the audience, then I don't know how to decide which direction. I don't know if the dress should be black or blue. And my art director won't either. But lots of times, if I can take that core, if I can take that direction and give that to my art director, she doesn't have to ask me what color to make the dress. She knows better than I do because that's her milieu. That's her wheelhouse. She's now empowered to figure that out.
Yeah.
And so that's the same thing with all these other strategies. If you don't have a vision, if you don't have a message that you're trying to help the world with, then it doesn't matter your email strategy or what software you're using. None of that stuff matters. It matters first, like what gets a fire going in you and what makes you delighted. Because if that's not there, nobody else is going to have it either.
That sounds kind of like what Larry Cohen's style of writing when he was still with us. Because one of the things that he did was whenever he had an idea for a specific story, he would write that scene, the scene that gave him the idea for it. That's what he would write. And then he would go backwards to see where in the story it would lead up to that scene, and then after the scene to see where it goes from there. And so, like, when I heard that on his documentary, King Cohen, which is fabulous as well, I just remember thinking, I got to try that strategy and see if that works, because I think that would open things up in terms of really increasing the production, I think, for myself.
Most of my stories begin with the end. I'll be thinking about different things or whatever, but at some point I'll come up with sort of an ending and I'll be like, oh, this is really good. And this is what I want to leave people with. Mm-hmm. And I will kind of write backwards from the ending, sort of like what you're saying, like, what do I do that leads into this ending? How can I set up everything? That's one reason, by the way, speaking of technical things, I do love writing in Scrivener. I wrote all my books in Scrivener on my iPad, only brought them to the desktop to finish all the formatting and everything. So if you get one of my paperbacks, you're looking at the camera-ready PDF that I made in Scrivener on my laptop. If you get one of the eBooks, you're getting the EPUB file that I made in Scrivener. So from idea all the way to publishing, completely in Scrivener, iPad. But
that's great.
That's one reason I like it, is because of the binder style format. I don't have to write linearly. I can work on that very first novel that I started writing at 2 a.m. at Waffle House. I wrote the first couple of chapters, and then I kind of thought, well, what story am I telling here? And I kind of made some notes and outlined some things. And so what I have right now is I have 10 chapters, but it's not the first 10. It's the first 7 and the last 3. And now I've just got to kind of fill in some of the stuff in the middle. Of course, it'll all get rewritten and everything. But again, it goes back to that same idea of, because here's the deal. Any art form, yeah, I do it because I love doing it. And yeah, I do it because it delights me. But especially something costly in effort and money and time, like a film, if I'm making that just for me, that's a huge waste. The whole reason I'm making it is for you, so that you can understand the story or the aha moment that I've had, so you can have that too, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Books are the same way. Why would I spend all this time writing a novel and getting it edited and publishing it and all that stuff? It's for you to read. And so even though we watch movies alone or we read a book by ourselves, it's still very much a social event. Even just reading a book by yourself is a social event, because it's the words of someone else speaking to you and you're listening to them. And so there's always at least two people involved in the experience, you see. Mm-hmm. And so what I love about sort of creating in the space is being able to take something and give it to somebody else. And so if that's my purpose, then I don't necessarily write a scene the way I want it. I write a scene so that it communicates in the best way for my listener. Everything's a script device. Everything's made up. So why not make it so that my listener gets that message, gets that sort of seed of knowledge or whatever that I'm trying to plant in their soil, and put it in a way that they'll be able to understand it. And that has freed me up a lot to write and to create, because I don't feel so bound by, like, oh, it has to be the way that I want it to be. Now it's like, okay, I really want to make sure that this is communicating the best to the person that I'm writing for. And again, writing backwards and writing in Scrivener has really empowered me to do that a lot.
Fantastic. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
So I'm Gidmore P personally on most social media stuff. You can go to parabolos.com and that'll link to a lot of the things there. parabolos.com. Parabolos is my production company. So there you'll be able to find the short films and links to the other movie pages. You'll be able to find links to the books, links to the audiobooks, links to podcasts and blogs and other stuff. And you can go to 5coffeesinabook.com and there you'll be able to get the ebook of The Darkness Rolled Over Her for free. You'll be able to get the 5 Coffees in a Book discussion guide for free, so that you can read the book, share it with a friend, make friends for life. And so if you got parabolos.com and you got 5coffeesinabook.com, you can pretty much find everything that you'd probably want to find. So
fantastic. And this has been just such an inspiring conversation as well. So I'm really excited for all of you who have been listening. And I hope that the fire is going, like, in your belly to get your own stories out there. And the main things that you really got to remember from this is you just got to know what sort of format works for you in terms of getting your story out there. Which one is it that you feel passionate about? Because if you're not passionate about the story itself that you're telling and how you're telling it, then just like how the passion for your story is going to bleed out onto the page, so will the apathy. And that is definitely something to keep in mind. So commit to getting that, whatever format it is that you are going to get it out there. And if it winds up being more than one format, even better. But commit to that format. If you're doing an audio drama, then you want to make sure you got your dialogue, your sound effects, And if there's music there, great. If there is a film, just make sure that you're presenting your story in a cinematic fashion. If it's just going to be a book, then focus on that. If it's just going to be a short story, focus on that. But whatever it is, get those stories out there and get them out there the best way possible that you feel will best reflect the kind of story that you want to tell. Because as I've said many times before on this show, in these crazy times, we need your stories. We need your vision. We need you now more than ever. So for Paul Skidmore, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.